and welcome to the 8th episode of the Functional Nerds. We're the guys who like to sit around and talk about Apple computers, science fiction and fantasy stuff, and music, because with an Alio, it's all about the music. And then we record it and share it with you, our faithful listeners. We appreciate both of you. I'm Patrick Hester. I am an author, a blogger, a podcaster. I own a cat who is going to be the next Sith Lord for the galaxy, I'm pretty sure. And I co-host this thing with my partner in crime, John Anilio. Say hello, John.
Hello. I am John Anilio. I write songs about science fiction and fantasy over at scifisongs.blogspot.com. Patrick and I have been doing this for 8 episodes now, and the last couple of episodes we've had some guests, and we're really enjoying having people become third nerds. And
heck yeah.
And today we are delighted to have budding superstar in the fantasy genre. We have Blake Charlton joining us. So Blake, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty good, and I gotta say, I'm really excited to be the third nerd.
Yes,
it's a distinguished honor.
Yeah, can I get a little? Do we get T-shirts? I mean, is there swag?
Well, you know what, Blake, is you're a technical. I mean, I don't know if we're gonna count the mind meld that you guys did the other day, but technically, officially, you are the third.
Yes.
Third nerd.
Yep. Oh. Wow.
So yeah. So bonus double.
So hopefully you got the gift pack. If you didn't, really sorry. I don't know why that didn't go out. Yeah. Now Blake is both a novelist and a medical student, right?
Yeah, that's my nerdy, the techie side of my credentials as a nerd.
Well, that's awesome. On the medical side, I noticed when I move my arm this way, I get a little twinge in my shoulder, and I would I'm just messing with you.
And for those of you who maybe don't know, although I think most of you listening to this podcast are probably pretty aware, Blake's debut novel is called Spell Right. It's an excellent book. I just finished it a couple of weeks ago, and we will talk much more about Spell Right later. But it's really been met with very positive reviews, and people seem to love Blake online too. Like, everybody that mentions his name on Twitter and everywhere else, you know, has nothing but good things to say, and I have nothing but good things to say about the book. So we're really delighted to have him here, and we're going to talk about a lot of stuff today, but we're going to really try to stay within Blake's wheelhouse. So in addition to talking about fantasy, we are going to talk, because Blake is a medical student, we are going to talk a little bit about some biomedical things and how they relate to science fiction and whatnot. So let's get on with it.
Yep. Tonight, since we do have a very unique perspective and point of view on the whole Nerds podcast, we have someone with us who's both a novelist and a medical student. So he's going through that, you know, and sleep is really overrated, right, Blake? I mean, you don't really need a lot of sleep.
Sleep is for the tired.
Exactly.
Exactly. You shouldn't. Why would you lie down and pretend to approximate death?
Think about all the time you lose with your eyes closed. I mean, exactly. It's just ridiculous. And science fiction is full of just fantastic medical advancements, some of which have actually come to pass in one way or another in today's world. Take, for example, Claudia Mitchell. She has something in common with Jamie Summers. She has a bionic arm. Claudia lost an arm at the shoulder in a motorcycle accident, but now she's using a computer-controlled, electric-powered arm to do almost everything that her own arm could do. She can peel and eat a piece of fruit. She can fold clothes, even wash the dishes. And all she has to do is think about what she wants to do, and the arm responds. It's just like something out of a science fiction novel. Doctors were able to move the ends of the nerves that used to connect to her mangled arm, or used to connect... I'm just tongue-tied. I'm nervous. Blake, it's your fault.
Sorry, I'll pipe down. I'll shut up.
Doctors were able to actually move the nerve endings that used to connect to her mangled arm to her chest and connect them to electrodes on a harness. And these electrodes on the harness, they detect the electric signals coming from those nerves and transmit them to a miniature computer. The computer translates them into signals that control small electric motors in the new arm and hand. So when she wants to pick up an apple, she just thinks about it, and her arm, hand, and fingers do it. So bionic arm. Awesome. In 2001, a multi-university team that included geneticists restored sight in blind puppies, which actually, when I read that, made me very sad because I was like, aww.
Aww.
Blind puppies. They were born with a genetic defect, and by inserting a corrective gene into their eyes, they were able to return their sight. Now, that same gene transfer technique is being tested on humans, which is just awesome. I mean, preliminary results indicate that it's not only safe for patients, but effective in restoring vision. And it sounds like something out of Star Trek. I keep remembering the scene from The Voyage Home where Dr. McCoy is you know, running through the hospital trying to get to Chekhov, and he comes across the lady who's on dialysis, and he hands her a little package.
Oh, that is a great line, too.
And he says, here, take this. It's like we're in the Dark Ages, and he walks away. And the next time you see that lady, she's on the cart just dancing, going, doctor gave me a pill, and I grew a new kidney.
What's the matter with you?
Kidney dialysis.
Dialysis? My God, what is this, the Dark Ages? Here. You swallow that, and if you have any problems, just call me.
Fully functional.
So just hilarious. How about this? The UF College of Medicine, their emergency medicine faculty are testing a wireless device the size of a cell phone that measures, stores, and transmits a variety of patient vital signs, just like a medical tricorder. So we know that science fiction can definitely influence the course of technology, but it seems to me like some of the greatest advancements have yet to be seen, and when they do happen, they're going to be in medicine. What do you guys think? It seems like science fiction really, it has influenced our technology, but most of the most coolest things are happening in medical technology.
Well, I definitely have to agree, and I think what interests me the most is the bionic arm you were talking about.
Oh, that's awesome!
And specifically, you know, the thing about that, the area I think is really exciting in medicine with regard to not just science fiction, but where it might go now, is this concept of what's called neuroplasticity. This idea that the mind isn't fixed and it can change. Because, you know, you mentioned that the patient's nerves were removed and replaced into her chest, and then she could think about doing something, and that would alert the bionic arm to act, right?
Right, right.
And if you think about that, that's pretty mind-blowing, because your brain doesn't have in it, has no experience of firing these nerves that were in your arm actually in your chest.
Mm-hmm.
And so what's happening is that your brain is literally rewiring itself and turning itself into an entirely different organ. And this idea of it's called neuroplasticity, the idea that your mind is kind of plastic, that it can be molded around and moved around. And it's a really, really ancient technology, if you want to think about it that way. And it maybe is what pulled, it's maybe what made us finally get our act together as a species. But the things they're discovering they can do now with it, I think it's in a few years, it's really just going to blow our minds.
I've seen reports about the Army trying to make, you know, airplanes that you can fly by thought and all this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And when you talk about like the bionic arm, it just blows my mind thinking that you could train your mind to move that piece of machinery.
Right, right. And it's funny because the mind, you know, when I think about this a lot, and especially in for the second book I'm writing, I think a lot about the idea of perception and about neural perception. When the idea of biofeedback and perceiving how these things work is pretty amazing. We can now, if you've lost the ability to balance, they have a device now that it has little tiny electrodes which they will attach to various points on your tongue, and your tongue has really, really a lot of nerves, and it's very sensitive, and it's got a little I forget what an engineer would call it, but it's a level, and it can tell you how level you are, and it will give little shocks to your tongue. They don't hurt, they feel like, you know, kind of a champagne bubble is what I've heard. But if you do this for long enough, your brain will figure out that the shocks on your tongue correspond to the ground.
That's right? Cool.
Right. And if you think about that, the technology, what your brain needs to do to rewire a sensation coming from your tongue and say, oh, we used to get this from the cochlea, from the inner ear, and we're not getting it anymore. Let's change all that. That's it just blows my mind.
I'm sorry, Anilio, but that's like rerouting power through the secondary ODN conduit. Go ahead.
Yeah. What I was going to ask about the concept of of neuroplasticity. Now, does the actual brain change the way it looks, and do certain things get bigger or smaller, or is it just purely the way, you know, the neurons are connecting and all that kind of stuff? Or does it actually look different if you were to, you know, say, you know, be able to really study someone's brain, or even if, you know, someone had an autopsy or something and you looked at their brain, like, do you know, could you actually see a difference?
Yeah. Well, the idea of, so I'm not a neuropathologist, I should say just up front, and someone out there might be and listen to this and will roll their eyes as I say this. But my understanding is that, you know, and the term we would use is, you know, gross anatomy. Like if you just cracked open a skull and you looked at it, no, it actually, it wouldn't look very different at all. In fact, a good example of that is a phenomenon called the phantom limb phenomenon.
Okay.
If you lost a limb, your brain might, and the limb was in pain or in a certain position, all of a sudden your brain isn't receiving input from that particular part of, you know, that part of your cortex is no longer being told where your limb is. So the cortex might assume whatever it was feeling last, it is still feeling. So a lot of unfortunate amputees have what's called phantom limb pain.
So it's like a residual memory, but it's like a residual memory kind of locked into your brain.
Exactly.
Of pain.
Right, right.
Yeah. Wow. One of the reasons I ask about that is because we, I think it was maybe, I'm a little behind, but have you seen the Flash Forward show?
No, I haven't. Yeah, well, actually, so to get to your question about the gross morphology, so what would happen is you still have that cortical map that corresponds to, let's say you lost your left arm.
Okay.
But and it's still there and all the neurons are still there, but it's not receiving input anymore. And your brain hates nothing so much as unused real estate. So what it would do is it would hook up to the nearest thing to it. And the nearest thing of your sensory map is actually your face. So some people, there was a case history I just read of somebody who had reportedly had an itch on their phantom hand because it itched right before the amputation. And he had this for something like 2 years, and he could never scratch it because he never had the hand. And the physician involved, the neurologist involved, went over his face with a Q-tip and found that by stimulating his face, he could stimulate the phantom hand, because this was cortical invasion. So to answer your original question, the brain, if you just looked at it, still has the same big structure.
Okay.
But that little path, that little like real estate that was wired to the hand, now is wired to parts of the face because that's next door.
Okay, so it's more like really like rewiring than anything else. If you were to make an analogy, yeah. The one thing I just wanted to bring up is on that Flash Forward show, they did there's a scene where they have an autopsy. And it ends up being on a savant, and they say, and I don't know how scientifically accurate this is, because I think they say that his, I'm probably getting the name wrong, but the part of the brain, is it the hypothalamus, which was larger, which I guess is typical, well, according to this. Okay. So I didn't know if that's something where it actually looked different, but this is more we're talking about wiring and how everything is connected.
Yeah, well, that's neuroplasticity, and there are that, you know, and I'm not going to know a whole much about it, but there are a lot of people out there that can tell you, you know, the different parts of the brains are enlarged or overstimulated in certain, you know, either pathological or unusual conditions, and I'm not going to be able to answer more than that.
Okay, awesome. That's
So, in other words, John, there is no chance that you're going to turn into the ultra humanite.
Okay, just checking. Yeah, no, because it's really the brain is it's really amazing how you know everyone's brain is a little different. You know how every you know as I was saying before the show, I work in education and I work with children on the autism spectrum, and it's amazing, and I am a music teacher, how some children actually who, you know, have so many other difficulties in their life, they're musically some kids that I work with on the autism spectrum really get it and have a much greater, deeper understanding of it, or just they're much more natural at it. So it's like, it's almost like some things that their brain is struggling with and other parts are, you know, excelling almost. It's almost like some parts of the brain are, I don't know if I would say overdeveloping, but are, you know, developing so much differently mm-hmm. than other things. There was a clip going around about a savant in, I think it was England, and it was like a 60 Minutes feature where he could play essentially any piece of classical music on the piano that he'd ever mm-hmm. heard. Hmm. It, you know, didn't really, I don't even think he read music or anything. He just like had such an ability to hear it and then process it through the piano. But then when they would ask him really simple questions, and I think this was like a 16-year-old or something, when they'd ask him simple questions, he'd have trouble with it. He didn't even know where he was most of the time. You know, like they asked him if he'd like to go swimming, and he's like, no. And then his mom was there and she was like, you go swimming every day, you know. So, but he was this genius at the piano. So it's so interesting, the brain.
What about that? There was that one kid who you could take him through a city and he would just look at everything. And then, you know, afterwards he would sit down and he would draw the city. And I mean, he would draw the architecture down to the most minute detail. Mm-hmm. And he could just replicate the entire city. But yeah, just like you're saying, you know, if you asked him where he is or what he's doing, he didn't have a clue.
Yeah.
Well, there's a book I read recently, and John, you actually might really be interested in it. The book is called Musicophilia. Don't ask me to spell it. by Oliver Sacks. And the subtitle is something like Tales of Music in the Brain. And okay. There's a whole chapter on musical savants, what you're talking about, and mm-hmm. Savantism. And the really fascinating thing that you just mentioned, actually, about the boy who draw out the entire city is that the ability – they now believe, and who knows, maybe they'll believe something different in 10 years. But it's now believed that all of us have a capacity for savantism, and that, in fact, there are different modalities within the brain that kind of work on a balance checks and balances system. And the reason why one system is never like terribly, terribly good is it must compete with another system so that, we can't draw everything out in perfect detail because the motor center and the visual processing center is to some extent being checked by an abstract thinking and verbal center. I might have that wrong. But if you were to knock out the verbal center, and so the person couldn't understand the question, like, do you want to go swimming? If you were to knock that out, you would, quote unquote, unmask the savant.
Interesting.
That's kind of like, yeah, it's almost like resource management. Mm-hmm. You know, not to become too computer nerdish here, but, you know, you've got your computer and your computer has X amount of resources that it can support. So mm-hmm. you only have so much RAM. You only have so much hard drive space. And so what the computer does is it chooses, you know, oh, if you've got Photoshop open, Photoshop is a heavy resource, so I need to devote enough computing power to make that work. When you open up something else, now it splits the resources between the two. Open mm-hmm. a third one, and again, it's kind of your brain, it almost sounds to me like, is managing all the different things that you're doing and devoting, you know, as much resources as it can. And so, you know, maybe the normal person walking around has got, you know, 20 different things going on. And that's why they may not necessarily be, you know, able to draw the city because right. they're working on, you know, oh, what am I going to do for dinner? Oh, what's this going, you know, they've got all these different thoughts going on. So mm-hmm, it's almost mm-hmm. like multitasking.
Yeah, it's Blake, I've seen that book a couple of times and I haven't gotten around to reading it yet, but it's certainly one that that's been on my radar. Have you seen, there's a documentary about the brain and music. It's called Music Instinct, Science mm-hmm. and Songs. It's on, you can actually, if you have Netflix, it's on the streaming. You can watch, there was a PBS special. And they, Bobby McFerrin plays a big part in it. And
oh, wow.
They mm-hmm. have all of these, a bunch of different musicians and then a bunch of different neurologists studying sort mm-hmm. of the music's impact on the brain and why we developed it and what's the reasoning for it. Because, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. you know, usually we develop things for survival, And why do we still have music? You know, what's this? And there's a very interesting scene where they have the guy from, there's a singer, I think his name is Jarvis Cocker. He was in an English band called Pulp. And they have him and a friend of his, and they're playing guitars and they're singing. And he's in an MRI. So they're actually like scanning his brain as he's singing. And they were sort of checking sort of the activity of his brain while he was singing. And they've done that before. But the thing was, because he was singing harmony with his friend, it was more active, because when you're singing harmony, you're really listening to someone else too. So it's activating your brain in a different way rather than just singing. You're sort of trying to anticipate and match, and it's very. If you're interested in the brain at all, it's a really interesting documentary and very entertaining. So definitely worth checking out. Definitely.
Well, and something else, since we're science fiction nerds, there is, and I think Oliver Sacks mentions this in the book. There's an Arthur C. Clarke, I think it's a novel, Childhood's End. The alien creatures in there, I think they're the overlords. They asked that exact question you asked. You know, why are these human beings spending hours and days and times producing music when it doesn't seem to have any communicative value, and et cetera, et cetera. I think I read that a long time ago when I was in my Arthur C. Clarke phase. But it might make that connection even more strongly for you.
Yeah, no, I'll definitely check that out, and I'll definitely check out that Oliver Sacks books.
Before you go on, Anelia, I have to throw out there that it's now your fault that I have that damn song stuck in my head.
Which one is that?
Here's a little song I wrote. You might want to sing it.
Note for note.
Don't worry. Be happy. In every life we have some trouble, but when you worry you make it double. Don't worry. Be happy. Don't worry. Be happy now. Don't worry.
His fault.
So whatever.
Anyway, I didn't mean to derail you, John.
It's fine.
I mean, you totally got that song stuck in my head, and I probably haven't thought about that in weeks.
Yeah, I use that song all the time when I'm teaching lessons about multi-track recording, because as silly as that song is, and it's funny because Bobby McFerrin is actually a very respected jazz singer.
Oh, yeah.
And was just like his one little pop hit that he had.
And he hates it. He will not play it. He will not sing it.
Yeah, he doesn't perform it.
I think he won't even acknowledge it anymore. Which I don't doubt it. I don't blame him.
Yeah, it's interesting as a teaching tool though, that song, because you might not even realize it, but that every sound on that recording is his voice. There are no instruments on that song. That's all just him, you know, singing bass lines and doing different percussive sounds. So anytime I teach something about multi-track recording, I always play that. For my students, and because I think if you're just someone that's not really paying attention too much to it, I think it's very easy to mistake some of those sounds for actual, like, you know, keyboards and bass and things like that.
Yeah, well, he always reminded me of the guy from the Police Academy movies, because
Michael Winslow.
Yeah, because he can make all those notes and those sounds, and it's awesome. Yeah.
But in that documentary, he's fascinating. He's a very intelligent guy, and just like a encyclopedia on you know, music history and music production, and he's a great addition to that. One of the guys, I think it's Daniel Levitin, who also wrote a book about the music and the brain, is sort of one of the big neurologists in that, and he was interesting because he started out as a music producer, and then it almost kind of reminds me of Blake a little bit, because he had a lot of success as a music producer, and then he sort of dropped that and went back and got his PhD in neurology. And then has sort of focused his neurological work on music, but another very interesting second career kind of guy.
And I can see that with Blake. I mean, he's got the medical school thing, and national healthcare hits and that doesn't work out, he can fall back on the novelist thing.
Exactly. Oh boy.
Political podcast.
I just like to tease just people about that.
Yeah.
All right. The brain is an interesting thing, and it's kind of funny because my podcast is All Things From My Brain, and I did that because although I've never been diagnosed in any way, shape, or form, I've always joked that I am a little ADD, and I can't, you know, focus on one thing. You know, it's like every other blog on the planet, people focus on a topic. SFSignal.com, they're focusing on science fiction. You know, you go to the Huffington Post and they're focusing on politics. You go to all these other blogs, they're focusing on some sort of topic. Me, I decide for All Things From My Brain. You know, so I can talk about anything that I want to talk about. And if one week I want to talk about comics, I do that.
Well, and to bring it back to kind of the connection to the brain and the music, I wonder if, John, if you've ever encountered anybody who experiences musical synesthesia, which is a kind of an interesting phenomenon.
Well, you know, I was going to ask you about that. Why don't you give a little bit of an explanation of what synesthesia is? Because I've read about it a little bit, and you actually talk about synesthesia, or you use that as a concept in Spellwright. So why don't you give listeners a little bit of an explanation of what synesthesia is? And I can actually use a little bit of an explanation myself. So
sure. I am endlessly fascinated with the phenomenon of synesthesia, and it plays a significant role in book one, Spellwright, but it's much bigger in Spellbound. So I've just done a fair amount of research on it. I'm very happy to talk about it. Synesthesia is a funny a neurological phenomenon in which a perception of one particular stimulus is either associated with or shunted to another perception. The most common, one of the most common ways of synesthetic perception is a musical synesthesia. People who have perfect pitch, so if you play for them a note, they know exactly what note it is. Some of these people experience that note as actually a color, which isn't to say that it occludes their visual fields. They're not going to run into anything if they hear this note, but the sensation of that color is excited, and it's basically like their auditory cortex kind of reaches over and kind of taps the visual cortex at the same time in that particular color. And so they can tell you right away, you know, that's B flat or that's F sharp because of its particular color. And, you know, I'm not a musician. I'm, in fact, fairly tone deaf. But I have a lot of friends who are musicians, and if you talk to them about a color, about sounds, they will use light as they will say, you know, this is a very, you know, this is a bright sound. You know, these are the blues. Some people I've even heard of people talk about like chrome, a particular tint to a sound. Sure. So that's a very common form of synesthesia. The most common form is, which sounds bizarre to me, but people who associate days of the week with a color. So they will always see Mondays as blue, Tuesdays as red, et cetera, et cetera. That apparently – it's still a fairly rare phenomenon, but that's fairly rare. A famous synesthete, I'm blanking on his name even though he's famous. He wrote a book called Born on a Blue Day.
Yes, Daniel Tammet, I believe, is his
name.
There
you go.
I read that book, yeah.
And he's a numerological synesthete, so he experiences numbers as colors, and so when he or shapes, and so when he does mathematical functions, he experiences it visually and auditorily. And I take this idea and I import it into my magic system. My magic system is a fairly simple idea, which I make probably way too complex, way too fast. But I'm a nerd and I'm like that. The idea is that language is itself kind of a technology. It takes place in a world where anything you write down on the page, you can peel off and be made, and the letters and the words become physically real, and they can go out and do things in the world if you've written them down correctly. If you've written them down incorrectly, they might blow up or wrap around your neck. The text that you write down correctly to do something would be a spell. That which you write down incorrectly is a misspell. And I tap into the idea of synesthesia because I wanted to work with individual languages within this world as different technologies. And in this world, you can only perceive a particular language if you're fluent in it. you will see the runes themselves are they glow. They're kind of incandescent. And if you're fluent in that language, you can see those runes either on paper or moving about in the world. But if you can't, if you don't know that language, you perceive it in a non-visual way. So someone, and this is called your synesthetic reaction. So someone who isn't fluent in a particular language called numinous, if they don't know that language but a numinous spell is active near them, they might hear a distant bell ringing, or they might feel slightly nauseated because that is their synesthetic reaction. And wow. So I got really fascinated with this concept. And so that's how it plays into book one. And in book two, I go bananas with it.
I would be so screwed in your world. I am such a terrible speller. I'd be choking on my own words.
Well, yeah. So that's the thing. You know, I'm severely dyslexic, and I didn't learn to read till I was about 13. And I learned to read by sneaking science fiction and fantasy into my special ed study hall. And I'd read, you know, Ender's Game and Robert Jordan and Ursula K. Le Guin. I'd read them surreptitiously under the desk. And I'm still a miserable speller. And in this world, the hero is quite good at making the letters, but he has a disability called cacography. And whenever he touches a text, it automatically misspells and flies all over the place.
Now, just out of curiosity on the dyslexic part, why did you have to sneak the books in?
Because we were supposed to be doing spelling drills. We were supposed to, you know, I was supposed to be writing out these things all the time. I wasn't supposed to be reading for fun, which was ironic because they had been giving me tasks to read and chores to do all my intellectual life, but nothing had inspired me to put in the raw hours you have to put in if you have a disability.
I don't get that because from my perspective, if you give a kid something that they're actually going to enjoy, they're going to read it. They're going to want more. They'll mm-hmm. read more. So I don't, you know, that's one of the things that it's always bugged me about school was, you know, when they would force you to read something that you didn't really care for.
Yeah. And I think it's changing now. I mean, it used to be, I remember
it
when
is,
I
yeah.
was... When I was in school, I'd get in trouble for having comic books, right? Because there were too many pictures and not enough words, right?
Right.
And as I understand it now, the education system is a bit more understanding. And
yes. Yeah. Well, it's much more progressive these days, I think, than it was when we were in school.
I hope so. Yeah. I really do.
Let me ask you a question, Blake, because I'm very interested in this. Now, when you're talking about are you – in terms of with your dyslexia and a lot that I've read is that, you know, about you and, you know, other podcasts that I was doing is, you know, overcoming your dyslexia. Now, is it still difficult for you to read? Do you still have a very hard time reading at this point?
No, reading. I've been doing it for so long that I'm probably about average speed. I don't know, compared to other medical students, I might be slower than okay. my peers. But the area where I do have problems is when I encounter a word I have not yet seen written or heard said out loud that is from either French or English. Hmm. Mostly I'm pretty lucky because in medicine, most of our words are either alphabet soup
Latin.
They sound like – yeah, or Latin or Greek. And Latin and Greek is very easy to sound out.
Okay.
And one of the things I didn't realize until I began looking into this is that, you know, certain disability, you know, any disability is an interaction between a capable body and an environment that takes away that capability. So if you look at per capita number of dyslexics in populations that speak English, you'll get some number. And then if you look at that same per capita number of dyslexics in populations that speak Italian, you will get 1/3 that number. Because the way to spell in Italian makes perfect logical sense. So it's very hard to be dyslexic in Italian. It's very easy to be dyslexic in English.
And yeah, we were talking a little bit, I'm sorry, John, but just before
go,
you...
Go for it, yeah.
Before you jumped in onto Skype, we were just kind of chatting before the show. My boss is dyslexic, and I want to say he's in his late 50s, if not... his very early 60s. I don't think he's in his 60s, but I could be wrong. And he's dyslexic and he struggles a lot. And it sounds to me like, you know, being a younger guy, people understood more about it and kind of how to help and how to treat. One of the things that, you know, I was curious about with you was how you write, because what I've noticed with him is he uses Dragon speech recognition software on his computer. That's the only way he can write, even emails to people. He has to use that.
When you're putting out something that, you know, I was very fortunate. I'm 30 years old. If you were born around the time I was, maybe a little bit before even, you were part of what's kind of in literature called like Generation Zero. We were the first group of people who was identified very early on. I got my diagnosis in first grade. And those people who had dyslexia beforehand, many of them weren't diagnosed. Some of them still aren't diagnosed, but many of them weren't diagnosed until they were in their 20s or 30s. And so they developed often, and a lot of them are very successful in non-traditional ways, and a lot of them are actually businessmen. Charles Schwab is a famous example of somebody who had a lot of get up and go and intelligence and felt like he couldn't use it in the traditional way, and so just went off and became a millionaire.
Like my boss. Yeah, he started his own mortgage banking company. So,
and it's very common for successful dyslexics who are older than Generation Zero to be in business. Because they had capability, they just couldn't. They didn't have the academy was not treating them right, basically.
Gotcha.
So when I write, there are two ways I write. I write with a computer, just on Microsoft Word, and I get the red underline all the time. And the biggest hazard for me are homophones, words that make the same sound. Because like once a word makes a sound for me, a word is just a sound for me. It's almost not something that's written.
Are you saying you're homophonic?
Quite often, whenever I write, I'm a homophile. In fact, homophonophile. In any case, clothes like close the door or like clothes that you wear, same sound. So I might I literally would have trouble seeing the difference, but my visual perception of those two things is very difficult. So I turn in medical reports and no one freaks out, and I haven't done anything disastrous in that regard. So my spelling is pretty remediated. But sometimes, especially when writing creatively, I will write longhand. I'll get out my Moleskine journal and write with a pen, because then the little red squiggle doesn't show up. Right. And the little red squiggles is just like one more thing to turn your internal editor a little bit higher. And sometimes you just need to tell your internal editor to shut the hell up so you can, finish the chapter of the story. So,
yes.
Yeah. Now, the Blake, what I wanted to ask you with that is sort of in terms of how you figured out how to read it. Now, you were just saying you made the comment of like putting the hours in. Do you think that has anything to do with that concept that we spoke of earlier about the neuroplasticity? Do you think you just taught your brain how to do it? Like your brain, you just had to like work on it until it made those connections?
Very, very much so. And this ties into another big idea that's kind of gaining ground now that's called the neurodiversity movement. And the neurodiversity movement is the idea that a lot of things that we identify as neuropathological, so things that we call disorders or problems, are in fact within the normal range of neurological human development, and that it's the conditions of modern society that make us call these things diseases when in fact they're not actually diseases. Most of the research in the movement and the fuel for this comes from the folks in the autism spectrum disorder your community or condition. Dyslexics, we kind of hang out in there too. We come to the bar, have a drink, but we're not there quite so often. But one of the ideas is that my brain is, and the brains of other dyslexics are wired to look at words and change them into sounds. And they've done what's called fMRIs, functional magnetic resonance imaging. And while asking dyslexics to read, and they see that our brains light up in many different places, but not the usual visual places that neurotypicals, that where their brains light up. But over time, because the brain is plastic, as we talked about, we begin recruiting more and more different parts of the brain, and we lateralize those functions, and we never quite our brain activity never quite looks normal, but it continues to become more neurotypical upwards to our 30, 35. You know, and we tend to think falsely so that the brain kind of is done at somewhere around 22. And it's not really going to be changing a whole lot. But in fact, it keeps evolving and it becomes plastic. And and a lot of folks that are neurodivergent, or I think the better term now is neurodiverse, we reach a similar level of, some of those connections are made a little later on for us. So I've gotten, through my 20s, I've gotten faster and faster and become a better and better speller. Not that I'm terribly fast or even a very good speller, but one of the things that I think the dyslexics and people with visual processing disorder who are a little bit further down on the road in their 30s or 40s would like younger people to know is like, don't stop. Right. Just because you're 18, right? Like you're still going to get better. Most other people will give up and they'll get worse, but you can still get better.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting because I do work with and it is a spectrum with the autism, because it's I must see 20 or 30 kids, and it's every one of them is totally different strengths and, different skills and things I need to work on. And one of the things that I've read about that really brought it home to me in terms of, my son is on the autism spectrum as well, and he is very young. He just turned 4, and we have a lot of therapy for him. It's called ABA, which is called Applied Behavioral Analysis, and that's one of the treatments used. And it's just very repetitious. It's sort of training the brain. And it's one of the things that I was sort of sold on. It is sort of, as of right now, it's one of the only therapies that is sort of has research to back it up that it worked. But one of the books that I read that sort of made the correlation to music is that, people don't wake up and know how to play Chopin on the piano.
Right.
It's something. Cool. Yeah, it would be cool. But most people can't just sit down and just play the piano brilliantly. They have to work on these motor skills and really just hammer away at it. And I know just from my own, training as a musician, I didn't just learn how to play the guitar one day. I practiced, upwards of 8 to 9 hours a day at one point through high school and college. And
yeah, you're a show off.
I am. I totally am. But the point is that it was training my brain and my motor skills to do this. And when someone made that analogy, it's like, all right, well, this is not a typically developing brain. It needs help to develop these skills. And so it's very interesting with the whole idea of the neuroplasticity and about how it can keep improving or getting better, or however you want to call it. But it's a very interesting field. And there's a lot of people out there within that are, neurally divergent, I suppose.
There's another really interesting connection to make really quickly, which would be with a book recently, I think it was 2 years ago, came out called Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell.
Yep.
And he looked at what makes people really phenomenal and really successful. And one of the things he discusses is the number of hours you have to put in to become an expert at something. Mm-hmm. And for any activity or any person, it seems to be 10,000 hours.
Yes.
You need to have 10,000 hours. And I would, it took me 10 years to become a published novelist and work at all those skills. And I think at some point there are, of course, Cinderella stories where, people just write a bestseller when they're 22 or something like that. But I really think that's exactly right with almost any kind of intellectual endeavor. You just need the 10,000 hours.
Yeah. That made a big impression on me, that book as well, that it's, he points out, I think he talks about Michael Jordan and he talks about the Beatles and about how even the Beatles as a band probably put in 10,000 hours. Sure. I mean, I think the Beatles are sort of considered this, you know, that they came to America and they were big stars, but they were sort of sweating it out in clubs in Germany and stuff. And yeah, it's true. I think it is. And I think about my own, just sort of in terms of quality of music production, you know, I don't think I wrote good songs until I was almost 30, because I was writing songs all through my 20s. And a friend of mine who's a folk singer-songwriter made an interesting point about it, which kind of goes along with that 10,000 hours, is he said, yeah, you probably have to write about 100 songs before mm-hmm. you start writing good ones. You know, mm-hmm. and you just mm-hmm. have to go and bang those 100 songs out. And, you know, some people take 10 years to bang out 100 songs. Some people may bang out 100 songs in a year, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot of mm-hmm. just how much time you put into it. And another book along those lines is, I think it's called Talent is Overrated, which is sort of arguing the concept that talent exists at all, that it's mostly the time you put in or the exposure that you put into, and mm-hmm, you know, what, mm-hmm. what your parents exposed you to. You know, sure. my son is really musical. Is he, you know, a gifted musician? Maybe. It's probably also because my wife and I are musicians and we've sang to him utero, yes, and he has music every day all the time. So, you know, I'm sure that has a lot to do with it. You know?
Well, and you know what? I look at, you know, I don't have kids of my own, but I have lots of friends and cousins and different people who have kids, and I'm Uncle Pat to probably a dozen or more kids. And my friend Quinn has, I want to say that his oldest is 6. And you know, the kid has been using a computer since he was 2.
Yeah, yeah.
And they took him in when he was first going in for kindergarten, and the teacher was talking about, oh, and by the time, you know, the year is over, he'll know how to use a mouse. And they're like, he has more honor kills on World of Warcraft than we do. You know, so I definitely think there's a lot to be said for what you expose your kids to when they're young, no matter, you know, how their brain works or what's going on. Because really, I think if you look at this entire conversation that we've been having, what I'm taking away from this is that, you know, no matter who we are, our brains are awesome.
Right. Yes.
And they can do a lot of stuff. And, you know, if this area isn't quite working for you, this area over here is going to work really cool and you might be able to do great stuff over here. And yeah. it to some extent, you can even train it to pick up for what it's not doing over here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Patrick, and I think you just coined another great title, much how you coined the Functional Nerds podcast without knowing you did. I think you just came up with a great book title, like Our Brains Are Awesome. someone that's yours. That's whoever wants that. Go take it.
But yeah, John, you better get 2 points off the back end of that book deal.
Yeah.
So,
Blake, why don't you go? Oh, I'm sorry.
No, Patrick, no. Go.
Well, actually, can I get one of you guys to pimp your stuff first, just so I can see how it's done?
Oh, sure. Well, I'll pimp my stuff first. So you can find me on Twitter at twitter.com/JohnAnealio, JohnAnealio. My blog is scifisongs.blogspot.com. There is lots of free music to download there. And I'm working currently on a collaboration with Dale Chase, who is a nerdcore hip hop guy, and I'm about 3/4 of the way through. I recorded all my my vocals and my acoustic guitar, and I laid down some bass lines and some electric guitar parts today. Hopefully, I'll finish up the guitars by the end of the week, and it may see the light of day as soon as next week. So I'm very excited about that one. My album Sci-Fi Songs is available on iTunes and Amazon MP3 and CD Baby, and if you just put John Anilio or Sci-Fi Songs in the search engines there, you can find it. That's about it for me this week. Blake, why don't you go next and pimp your stuff?
This is huge, Blake. This is your first ever pimping of your stuff.
You can find me at Twitter at the very creative title tag of Blake Charlton. Blake like the crazy poet and Charlton like the crazy actor with the guns. My
you
website
damn
is
Dirty Apes.
Yeah, exactly.
Take your stinking paws off me, you damn dirty ape.
On my website, www.blakecharlton.com, you can find out more about first novel, Spellwright, which is out from Tor in the U.S., and HarperCollins Voyager in the U.K. later this month. And you can also find I have a free hard SF biomedical novelette for free on my story called Endosymbiont. You can check that out if you like. And just about 20 minutes before we started up this podcast, I finished up the first draft of my second novel, which will be called Spellbound, and it will hopefully see the light of day early next year, but I can't make too many promises because my editor hasn't told me whether or not it sucks. So, yeah, it's been a real pleasure to be here.
Awesome. And, of course, I'm Patrick Hester. I've got twitter.com/ATFMB, which stands for All Things From My Brain, which is also the blog, atfmb.com. I have serialized a piece of fiction called Evermist, and that's on the web at atfmb.com/Evermist. And then we also have functionalnerds.com, where we have this podcast. We just did a very special 2-hour roundtable podcast that's up there. And when my work firewall allows, I do a daily nerd news roundup. Now, Blake, we really appreciate you being on the podcast. It was awesome. We had a lot of fun.
Hey, that was my pleasure.
You're a very smart guy, and I can see you going very, very far in both careers.
Well, thank you very much.
One of the things that we did want to talk about is we've decided and we've talked you into signing a book and letting us give it away.
Fantastic.
Now, the only problem is that you are a medical student, so my question to you, will people be able to recognize the signature?
You know, I'll get a friend who's a nurse to print whatever I write just below what I do.
There you go. So we're going to have a contest about that. And what we've talked about doing is we want you, the listeners, to go out and take a photograph of yourself holding Blake's book, Spellwright, and then email that to us. And I'm going to set up a special email address. Probably going to be spellwright@functionalnerds.com. And you send us those photos and we're going to share them with Blake and we're going to set up a little feed and we're going to pick a winner and send them the autograph book.
Or actually, can I pose a little idea?
Sure.
So one of the things in the book is that the different magical languages have different appearances. And if anyone's good with Photoshop or fancies himself an artist and wants to generate a graphical representation of what the different magical languages or spells might look like, I would be happy to also put that on my website and show that around a bit.
That would be very cool, yeah. And every time you do that, you'll get entered in, and then we'll just randomly pull a name and send you the book. Sound
and you
good?
you can read the first 5 chapters on my website, blakecharlton.com, and you can get all the information you need about what the characters and what the spells would look like.
There you go. And I'll put something up about the contest on functionalnerds.com as well. John, anything else you can think of?
No, I think we're good. That's great.
All right. Well, thanks again for coming on, Blake. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Hopefully you'll come on again sometime. You have, like John said, you have an open invitation anytime you want to be on.
Fantastic. Whenever I have time, I'll take you up on it.
Awesome. Well, sweet. Thanks for listening.
I'm gonna hype this one to people that don't even normally like to my like people that I know in real life, not just like my Twitter friends. Like, I'm
gonna sure.
Get my wife to listen to this, and like people that I know in real life to listen to this, because I think it's just endlessly interesting and something really important. So,
thanks, Mo.
I'd like to say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves. And I hope we pass the audition. Ha ha ha!